up, What's Going On with Bob Henley. Stay tuned.
There's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving gift here today. Picket lines, sister, and picket signs, sister. Don't punish me, sister, with brutality, sister. Talk to me, sister, so you can see.
Good morning, New York and New Jersey, as well as the great world beyond. This is Bob Henley at Stuck Nation, because we surely are. This is WBI's Drive Time News Magazine, What's Going On? Our focus is always labor. Catherine Davis is our audio engineer, and Linda Perry is our executive producer. This is the Monday morning back to work, back to school show. Sunrise was at 6:21. It's March 7th, and all this month, we will be celebrating Women's History Month and the pivotal role women have played in the American labor movement, often getting resistance not just from the bosses, but from the unions themselves. It's 59 degrees out under cloudy skies. We could break 70 degrees today and see a shower or two. Tomorrow it brightens up, sun-wise, but the temperatures will range from the low 50s to 50 degrees. Wednesday clouds give way to showers with temps in the mid-30s and only warming up to 43 degrees. Thursday looks more promising with temperatures breaking the 50s just barely. Friday, a clouds back up and temperatures hold steady. Saturday, there's an 80% chance of rain with temperatures raising from just below freezing to the mid-50s. Wow, we're giving this planet a run for its money. And Sunday, we'll get sunnier skies with temperatures only in the low 40s. This morning, we'll get an update on the David versus Goliath court win by New York City retirees who pushed back on the city of New York's plan to shift their health care to Medicare Advantage. We'll check in with Janelle Hines, who is the UFT's vice president for high schools and the secretary treasurer for New York City's Central Labor Council of the AFL-CIO. We'll speak with journalist and labor historian Jane Latour about her seminal book, Sisters in the Brotherhood: Working Women Organizing for Equality in New York City. And, of course, your calls at 212-209-2877. But first, the Pacifica Network News.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Russia's reckless operation around the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant risked a catastrophe, a nuclear incident.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke for many nations when warning about fighting around Ukraine's nuclear plants. Russia seized Europe's largest nuclear power station last week. At an emergency Security Council meeting Friday, UN Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield called that, quote, incredibly reckless.
And it threatened the safety of civilians across Russia, Ukraine, and Europe.
Thomas Greenfield urged Russia to withdraw from the plant, allow medical treatment for injured personnel, and permit full access to the site. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky held a virtual meeting Saturday with 300 members of Congress as lawmakers consider a White House request for $6.4 billion in aid. A ban on Russian oil imports is on the table. The U.S. may also provide replacements for Polish Soviet-era fighter jets that nation might send to its neighbor. The House passed a bipartisan resolution of support for Ukraine Friday. Representative Gregory Meeks, a New York Democrat and chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, introduced the measure.
Vladimir Putin has launched an unjustifiable, senseless war on a peaceful, sovereign nation.
Reuters reports at least 9,000 people have died from the violence and roughly 1.5 million people have been displaced. As the U.S. considers banning Russian oil imports, AAA reports prices at the pump have hit their highest point in over a decade, clocking in at just over $4 a gallon on average. In Wisconsin, the legislature's Republican leadership is asking the U.S. Supreme Court to review that state's redistricting battle. The move comes after the Wisconsin Supreme Court approved a voting map submitted by Democratic Governor Tony Evers. That map would shrink, but not eliminate the GOP's control of the legislature. Deborah Cronmiller with the League of Women Voters of Wisconsin says the Evers map is a bittersweet victory, since the state court previously ruled any new map would need to closely adhere to the state's current one.
Using the least change approach meant all of us who submitted maps for consideration were kind of boxed into a map that would retain certain amount of partisan gerrymander.
According to the Poynter Institute, Wisconsin's current voting lines are some of the most gerrymandered in the nation. They were drawn behind closed doors in 2011 and adopted when the GOP controlled both the legislature and governor's seat. The Florida State Senate has approved a measure establishing a new election crimes agency. According to the New York Times, it would be the first such state agency if approved by the House and Governor Ron DeSantis. According to the Associated Press, vote fraud is extremely rare. The AP confirmed fewer than 500 potential fraud cases out of 25 million ballots cast across six states, not including Florida. I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our eight trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Thanks, Jonah. Last week, an impressive grassroots coalition of New York City's retired civil servants won a big victory in court in their drive to resist City Hall's plan to shift hundreds of thousands of them to a Medicare Advantage program, which required them to pay almost a $200 premium to maintain their current coverage. With us now is Gloria Brandman, a retired UFT member and activist on many fronts, who's been providing us with periodic updates. Good morning, Gloria. Hate to say
good
it.
Morning.
What's going on? What happened in court?
Okay, well, we did have a wonderful victory last week, although it might be short-lived. And I'll tell you, with the situation in the world, we could all use a little bit of upbeat news from time to time. So what happened was on Thursday, a ruling was made by the court, by Judge Lyle Frank, regarding the case that you mentioned between New York City municipal retirees and the City of New York. He said that the city could move forward with changing retired municipal workers' health coverage from the traditional Medicare to a privatized Medicare Advantage on April 1st. But the decision also said that the city must allow current and future retirees to opt out of the shift and to keep the current health care plan that we have without having to pay the premium of $191 a month. This is kind of based on the court's reading, and this is technical. I don't totally understand it all, but it's based on New York City Administrative Code Section 12.124, which says as long as the respondent is giving retirees the option of staying in their current program, they may not do so by charging them the $191 the city intends to charge, because it says the city cannot charge retirees for health care unless it's above the cost of the HIP plan, and it is not. So this was good. And then later, a statement was issued by Michael Mulgrew, who is the UFT president, my president, and one of the main forces behind creating this health care change in the first place. He said, and I'm just going to read it quickly, he said, while the New York City Medicare Advantage Plus plan is sound, the program has suffered from serious implementation problems and poor legal arguments, particularly on the part of the city. Our retirees deserve better. Now he says that.
Wow.
And he said that the UFT is withdrawing its support for the April 1st start date and will urge the Municipal Labor Committee to suspend its efforts to begin the program until all the implementation and legal issues are resolved. Okay, so now he is the good guy for us. Although he's not saying it won't start, it's just until legal issues are resolved.
So I guess what I remember.
What's that?
I know. I just wanted to say, so just so I could circle back, as far as the administration, it's important to say the Municipal Labor Committee. That's the only noun that you would have left out. The Municipal Labor Committee, all of the unions, public unions, leadership endorsed this plan. I remember when you and Stu Eber came on, the Municipal Retiree Civil Servants One of the calls we got that I was very moved by, you may remember, was a 90-year-old, I think, retired teacher who talked mm-hmm. about how long ago she retired and what a real impact this fee would have on her.
Yes, I've heard from now, at this point, I've heard from many seniors who've told stories about how this could, you know, really decimate their health and maybe even kill them in some instances. It's very serious for many. And as we age, we're going to need more and more health care, and the MAP plans often don't work as well. So there were actually the two unions that, well, there were a couple of unions that voted against it. It wasn't unanimous.
You're right, true.
PSC and all of the all the health unions, the doctors and the nurses, they all voted no for this. But then what happened after Mulgrew made his announcement, the city announced that the new plan will not be implemented on April 1st, and we can stay the same. So the message from the Office of the City, the Office of Labor Relations, which is the city, and Mulgrew was that this plan is kind of dead, and there's no need to opt out. So we all find this very problematic, because suddenly maybe it could come right back to life. The judge didn't say it couldn't go into effect at all, just that if it does go into effect, we can't be charged for keeping the traditional Medicare.
So don't stand down. So what you're trying to communicate to people is your organization, all the grassroots work, cannot rest here. It sounds like with the city being willing to spend money in court, that you still have to continue in this struggle format.
Not at all. I mean, we're still encouraging all retirees to opt out anyway.
Right.
First,
right.
Just to make a strong statement as a protest. And just in case the switch, you know, reappears, I don't think it's going to reappear suddenly. But we do not think this is the end of it. The city has already started an appeal process. They might try to get the city council to change the statutory regulation, which is what this ruling was based on, even though we seem to have a more progressive city council now, this is still no guarantee that they're going to block this from happening. We don't know. And the other thing that could happen is this decision could allow the city to offer retirees only one plan, and it could be its preferred Medicare Advantage plan.
So how do people stay updated on this? That's the most critical thing so that you can keep developing the base of support for this resistance effort. Where do people go to get the latest information?
Okay, well, because you're absolutely right. The ground struggle we have been fighting isn't going to stop. We are, you know, regrouping and re-energizing. I work with CROC, which is called the Cross Union Retiree Organizing Committee. And we don't have a website, but we try to put out information on all
the
Facebook pages that are online. There is also the court case, the group that was doing the court case, and they're called the New York City Municipal Retirees for the Preservation of it's a long, long name, and they do have a website. They also have a Facebook page. I will get that to you.
Oh, thank you so much. And sorry about that musical burst here. Thank you so much, Gloria. Okay, you have done so much for this cause and helped us stay focused on it. We'll update soon. Perhaps by the end of the month, we'll know more about where we're going.
Well, thank you so much, because this to us is you know, very important. And like I say, in the world we're in now, we definitely need our very good health so we can continue on all fronts to make it
Thanks
a better
so much.
World. Thank you.
That was Gloria Brandman, retiree activist, and a real spark plug for what's going on. I am honored and privileged to be joined by Janilla Hines, who is UFT Vice President for Academic High Schools and the Secretary Treasurer for the AFL-CIO's New York City Central Labor Council, which is composed of 300 affiliated unions across the entire economy that represents 1.3 million workers. Good morning.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Well, I'm great. And so I just wanted to, if you could tell folks, is the first person's often the best way to engage people. How did you get involved in the union movement?
Well, my father was a unionized teacher and airplane mechanic, a proud member of the ATU and the United Federation of Teachers. And so I was doing youth work in the community, and he invited me to do work with young people that would allow me to experience a defined benefit pension and great health care and a voice in the workplace. And so I followed his lead and became a teacher in New York City.
Well, and so in terms of what has it meant to you in terms of your own personal and professional growth?
Oh, it's been phenomenal for me in my professional growth, for sure. The opportunity to be involved politically and to advocate for the needs of educators and the needs of students with elected officials has been one element of it, but also the opportunity to ensure that we have safety in our classrooms and in our schools, and that together we are fighting for the right professional learning so that we can continue to grow and continue to develop as professionals with the students that we teach and with the communities where we work. That has been instrumental, and I don't think any of that would have happened without our union.
Well, it's true. You have, you know, historically, the union movement, it's played a role in empowering women, but I am sure that there's also resistance that happens institutionally. And so I guess that's the challenge, right, is the unions have to be about the social change that they want in the broader society. If you could comment on that.
Oh, absolutely. I think in a very basic sense, many of us have been operating under particular images of what leadership looks like. And how it manifests itself, especially when we think about labor and we think about what fighting looks like. And what we have been experiencing in the labor movement, and I can say certainly in the UFC, but also in the Central Labor Council, and of course in the AFL-CIO nationally, is a shift in what it means to be strong, in what it means to lead, and what it means to show vision. We're seeing that with Liz Shuler in her presidency at the AFL-CIO, certainly at the UFT, with all of the women who are elected leaders across our divisions and in our schools, in our healthcare, and part of that has been allowing everyone to shift their thinking about how we manifest strength and collective power.
Well, and it's funny too, because if there is a contested race in there, I think there's only been one in the history of the AFL-CIO. It's been reported to come from perhaps Sarah Nelson, who leads the flight attendant CWA. So that would kind of be quite a narrative arc, right? If you could give me a sense of, you know, one of the things you alluded to is about workplace safety. We know that here in New York City, we lost close to 400 civil servants, including teachers, to COVID during the pandemic. According to the Kaiser newspaper, and the Guardian and Kaiser Health did a combined together to do this project. As of April, close to 4,000 healthcare professionals died from their occupational exposure to COVID. Didn't the pandemic reinforce the reality that being in a union was critical when it came to protecting workers and their families' health?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think what we saw during the past 2 years has been real advocacy on behalf of working people to ensure that there are safety measures in place, whether we are reporting to the work site or we are doing the work from our homes. For teachers, we had the challenge of figuring out how to do remote instruction
from our homes. We had to figure out how to upgrade our Wi-Fi and get the right technology in order to connect with our students every day. And for most of us, we were doing that while also caring for our children who couldn't report to school, or our elder family members who needed to be cared for in home and needed to be kept safe from COVID. And so that balance has been a struggle as well. And we've been trying to figure out all of that while, in most instances, the people who bore the brunt of the illness and the and unfortunately the death with COVID and the unemployment have been women across our city and across our state.
College, if you'd like to be part of this discussion, 212-209-2877, 212-209-2877. I guess the thing is that the pandemic highlighted, you know, we had the situation with the government and where employers, agencies, private corporations really let down workers in a major way. And we've paid it. We still right now, as we speak, do not know the toll on the essential workforce and even long COVID. Can you talk about how the pandemic highlighted, and you alluded to some of it in your answer before, to the existing societal inequities when it comes to women in the workplace, the lack of the infrastructure that OECD, Western democracy economies take for granted, like universal pre-K 4, which we know the Blasio administration got in, and an integrated child care program. Can you talk about how this has kind of highlighted that? I think we have like 2 million women that, as you say, because of the imperative of having to put their family first, have left the workforce.
Yes. And, you know, one of the projects that has been really important to us in the labor movement has been thinking about unionized childcare, because we know that when parents have quality childcare available for their children, they're able to be more productive at work. But childcare is so incredibly expensive. Folks are spending thousands of dollars a month in order to ensure that their children are safe. And so I can just give a quick plug for a program that we have here in New York State that we are lobbying for again with the New York State Legislature. It's called the Facilitated Enrollment Program, which was established for folks at middle income. We have programs for the lowest income people. High income people are able to afford quality child care. But for middle income people, and many of them are in unions, they need child care too. And so the Facilitated Enrollment Program was established in order to get unionized workers the child care that they need. But you're absolutely right, Bob. It's child care. It's elder care. It's access to mammograms and cancer screening. It's ensuring that parents are able to take time away from work, children while they are in school. And through collective bargaining, we're able to get many of those benefits for our members.
Now, one of the things is that in September, October, November, and December, the Bureau of Labor Statistics said that 17 million Americans quit their jobs. That's 5 million more people than are in the AFL-CIO. How does a union movement ensure that it remains relevant during the Great Resignation? Because the reality is the level of union participation is hovering around some a little over 10%. In the public sector, it's around a third. But how do you do that? How is it that, because what's kind of happened historically is that because of the fact that we did have a higher level of union engagement and enrollment back in the day, the American workers now have been dealing with, more broadly, the workforce, a real degraded social contract, right? Mm-hmm. Where they didn't get pensions. They used to have pensions, then the corporations hauled them out. And so, you know, that's a Scott Walker, Chris Christie trick of playing, and usually teachers are the ones that they use for this, playing off the social contract teachers have with mm-hmm. the degraded contract the American workforce has. How can unions counter this?
Part of it is the work that we do with working people, right? And so we are seeing across the country this amazing organizing drive by baristas at Starbucks and how we can listen to the needs of working people who may not be in their last career. They may not be like teachers planning to retire from being in their current workplace, but they do want to be safe and they do want to be respected and they do want to have voice. And what we in the labor movement can do is think about how we hear the concerns that they're raising, how we create networks with those working people, and how we can really adapt the ways in which we communicate, the ways in which we organize, the ways in which we advocate for change by working in partnership with those people who are not yet unionized.
Oh, and so like supporting the June 18th Reverend Barber Poor People's Campaign, mm-hmm. the traditional mm-hmm. role of engaging with the broader social change movements is what you're talking about.
Yes, yes. I think it's really important for us to think about that. It's if it's only people in unions who are going to be doing this work, then as you rightly noted, there are not enough of us to affect right. this kind of change. But we can work with other people of conscience to create laws that are more supportive, that that shore up the social network.
Right.
And that
we've got a bunch of callers. You're very popular. So let me go to the callers. Where are you calling from, caller? What's on your mind? And what's your name?
Judith from the Upper West Side. Thank you so much for what you're doing and everything. But please put out the opt-out phone number for all senior citizens to be able to call in and opt out from that horrible program to make that statement. And please make that a public statement that gets repeated on WBAI from time to time. Thank you. I'll get off the air immediately.
Thanks so much. And I will follow up with social media, and we'll do that. Next caller, where are you calling from? What's on your mind? What's your name?
Yes, Jose from Belgium. I've been proposing that we should divide what is resources and what is money. And we, the poor, have resources, most likely, and we can recycle bottles and produce the money if we train our family. That's one thing. But then the next thing is that we have to take in consideration that I worked 32 years in the 32BJ under the union, right?
Yes.
And my experience has been every year we lose ground and we lose ground because I hear both sides. I hear the ARB side and I hear the union side.
Right.
And the NLB say they want more money, we want to give them less. Anything they give us, they take like two or three times more. One example of that is building used to have managers, which is the realtors saying a manager. Now union has resident manager that is a super that was given the title to be resident manager that now operate, he take care of three buildings or four for little money. So there are three or four supers that were fired and managers that were fired because now they know how to handle those things.
We have a bunch of callers. I did want to thank you and have you call back in. I do want to focus on the issues you raise about 32BJ and about the way that these givebacks have happened over time. Please call again and stay tuned because we're going to cover it in depth. Next caller, please. Where are you calling from? What's your name? What's on your mind?
This is Brother David from Brooklyn, and I want to talk about teachers. What's on
your mind? Your radio's on. If you could turn it down, you sound like an experienced caller. Thanks. Go ahead. What's on your
Hello.
Mind?
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Yes. I'm thinking about this. What I have come to a conclusion is that what the ruling class in this country wants to do is to privatize the public schools. And I think this is a serious problem and turn public schools into charter schools and get rid of public school teachers. So I would like to hear what you think about that, because they're making it more difficult for teachers to get tenure now, and they would like to put in charters in place of public schools.
Right. I want to give we're coming up against the bottom of the hour, but thank you for calling. Janella, he hit all the points there. How would you like to respond to the group of callers, with starting with the last one, which is most germane to your expertise?
Yes, the privatization of the public school system is an issue that we have been fighting against for the last 15 years, and it remains a huge concern for our membership and for the leaders of the UFT. I will say that part of the work that we've been doing is thinking about how we can take advantage of the technology that we have available to us to create different forms of public school. So remote instruction, as we discussed earlier in the hour, has been a huge issue across our city. And we don't currently have, besides a very small pilot, a venue for meaningful remote instruction to happen with the public school system, with teachers who are qualified and educated and experienced, and who are under the umbrella of the New York City public schools. But that's something that can be negotiated. And I think we're thinking about how to take a chunk out of the kind of innovation that charter school managers propose for their society and for the communities in which they work, and try to re-envision what that looks like within the labor movement.
I have to say, I had a long list of questions. Your role as a social studies teacher, we had talked about the importance of the crisis that we have right now, which Mayor Adams is trying to deal with in terms of disconnected youth. We were looking at 1 in 4 16 to 24-year-olds in some neighborhoods, not in school and not in work. I would hope. Would you come back and talk about that?
I would love to come back and talk about that. I'm getting ready to teach my class and get with the young people that I currently work with. And we could certainly engage in quite a bit of conversation about what they're experiencing.
Would they like to come on the radio?
I'm sure some of them would.
Well, you give that as a special bonus, right, for class participation. What are the coordinates for people who want to get in touch with you, Janella?
So I am available on Twitter at Janella T. Hines. That's H-I-N-D-S. I am also at the UFT and at the New York City Central Labor Council.
Thank you so much, Janella. Look forward to speaking again.
Thank you, Bob. Have a great day.
You too. That was Janella Hines, UFT Vice President and Secretary Treasurer of the New York City Central Labor Council. We'll be back. The ground, and she's burning it down. Oh, she got her head in the clouds, and she's not backing down. This girl is on fire. This girl is on fire. She's walking on fire.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI New York with a moment in women's history.
If we do form a union, we are going to have a political force.
Since the 1950s, Dolores Huerta has been a grassroots organizer in the struggle for equality and civil rights.
People that aren't aware of labor relations don't realize why unions are important.
In the 60s, she co-founded the United Farm Workers and was the chair of contract negotiations.
You know, we did have a chance to sign a contract with the growers. Some of our liberal friends say, well, why didn't you sign that contract? It's a foot in the door is more important. Well, the reason that we didn't sign the contract is because the growers refused to put any protective language on the issue of poisons.
By the 70s, the Farm Workers Union led the charge against environmental racism and pollution with the campaign to ban the use of the pesticide DDT.
See, farm workers sort of took poisoning as a working condition, you know, the same way that they took a lack of a toilet or the lack of hand washing facilities or, you know, the bad treatment that you get. This was just an occupational, you might say, an ordinary thing.
At the time, a sampling showed 80% of farm workers, mostly grape pickers, as well as a large proportion of their children, were affected by DDT. They also found consumers were being affected by poison on the grapes that they were eating.
I think that the whole issue of pesticides that the union has taken on is an important one, because here we're taking on a basic issue that's not important. It's important not only to the farm worker, but to the consumer and also to the environment. And this is, I think, the union, we're certainly trying to make our union to be, to have a conscience, a social conscience that is larger than just the question of bread and butter.
Dolores Huerta later became a leader of the Feminist Majority's Feminization of Power campaign to inspire women, particularly Latina women, to run for public offices to reflect the diversity of the nation. She originated the Si Se Puede attitude, a personal and organizational spirit that promotes confidence, courage, hard work, and the belief that we can do the impossible, way before Barack Obama campaigned with the phrase, "Yes, we can." You can hear more from Dolores Huerta and other trailblazers by becoming a WBAI buddy, a sustaining member. For $15 or more a month, you'll receive our fabulous, extensive women's history collection and our tote bag. Please go to women.wbai.org, women.wbai.org, to become a WBAI buddy in the name of your favorite program or in the name of all WBAI programs. Or please call 212-209-2950. Do it now. Call 212-209-2950 and say, "Yes, I want to become a WBAI buddy this Women's History Day."
Thanks for that, Linda.
Marching, marching, we're standing proud and tall. The rising of the women means the rising of us all. No more the drudge and idler, and a toil where one reposes, but a sharing of life's glories, bread and roses, bread and roses. Our starve as well as bodies, give us bread, but give us roses. Bread and roses, bread and roses.
Bread and roses. Thanks, Phil, Linda. And as they say, there's more. I have 5 copies of my book, Stuck Nation, Can the U.S. Change the Course of Its History of Choosing Profits Over People, published by Richard Wolff's Democracy at Work. What I will I will personally mail these to listeners that become a WBAI buddy in the name of what's going on Labor Monday. Here's a Peggy Seeger with her "I Am Going to Be an Engineer." I'm married to one. We'll be back with labor historian Jay and Latour.
When I was a little girl, I wished I was a boy. I tagged along behind the gang and wore my corduroys. Everybody said I only did it to annoy, but I was gonna be an engineer. Mama told me, "Can't you be a lady? Mother of a pearl. Wait until you're older, dear, then maybe you'll be glad that you're a girl. Dainty as a Dresden statue, gentle as a Jersey cow, smooth as silk, gives creamy milk. Learn to coo, learn to moo. That's what you do to be a lady now."
I'm very pleased and honored to be joined by Jane Latour, a labor historian, activist, union member. Good morning, Jane.
Good morning, Bob. What a perfect song to do the intro. I love it.
So first of all, introduce yourself. I mean, you're people who are in the labor movement know you really well, but to a broader audience who's not in the union movement, how did you get into the union movement? What has it meant to you?
Yeah, well, what happened was I left home as a teenager, and I had no education, no talent, no skill. So I went and I just worked at all kinds of jobs that I could, you know, get hired into. And there I got a real education. And then I decided I needed more education to fight the bosses, which I started doing early on. Yeah. And I went to Rutgers and studied history. And then I went back into the labor movement, where I stayed the rest of my career. And I worked at all different kinds of jobs involving labor, like labor educator and labor archivist at NYU, and labor organizer for District 65. And so that's what I spent my life doing. And eventually I encountered the subject which became dear to my heart, which is the story of sisters in the brotherhoods.
Right, and that's what I wanted to ask you. What inspired you to write that? Sisters in the Brotherhood, working women organizing. I say sisters in the brotherhoods, working women organizing for equality in New York City. That was back in 2008, right?
Right. That's when the hardcover came out, and then the paperback, which is more affordable. And what happened was I went to work as the director of the Women's Project for a little group that's very wonderful, a national group called the Association for Union Democracy. What a concept. And I ran the Women's Project. And what happened at the AUD was that women kept coming to us with questions about how to get representation, because these women were working in skilled blue-collar jobs, a lot of the construction trades, but other unions, and they weren't being represented. They weren't being, you know, they weren't being given assistance in some very sticky, nasty situations. So we developed a real expertise on that. But as soon as I became the director, way back in 1989, I saw that these women were going into places that most of the rest of us never entered, and they were terrific witnesses. And not only that, but I was getting calls from across the country from women, but the women in New York City were organizing. And so I thought, I have to get a tape recorder and start recording their stories. And the first idea was to just do a brochure and not, you know, tell their stories. And one thing evolved into the next. So we did a manual for survival for women in the non-traditional blue-collar jobs. And it was small, so it could fit in their pocket, and it was everything A to Z that they needed to know. But that, you know, that got a good reception. And then I started going out publicly speaking about, based on these interviews, and that got such a good reception that it led to the book.
And so these professions, because I've been at some great events that you've had since, where female firefighters have been in attendance, stagehands, carpenters, electricians, I mean, the full arc. Can you talk about, because this is kind of the theme of the program. I talked about this, women, not surprisingly, are in this very difficult conundrum where when they are trying to get established, sometimes the resistance comes from within the unions and the patriarchy itself and the bosses. Did you document some of that tension? And have we moved? Have we improved from when you first published Sisterhood challenging the brotherhoods? I put challenging in there,
yeah.
But in essence, they were.
You know, yeah. What's the problem is that the women go into these jobs and think about it, pretty foreign place, pretty foreign workplace, and then they have to learn the rules of that job, challenging jobs, firefighting or ironwork or carpentry or whatever. And they have to learn that. And then they have to learn the rules of the union. And, of course, they don't want to be, you know, they don't want to, shoot themselves in the foot by, you know, complaining. So that is another conundrum. And then, you know, what I see with a lot of these situations, and it's interesting, just last week, I was walking with a friend who, she and her husband stagehands, and she told me that her husband's sister, who has read Sisters in the Brotherhood, by the way, but she works in one of these blue-collar mechanical jobs, and she's decided she's leaving, not because she can't do the job or she doesn't like the job, because of the misogyny and all around it. So when you say, have things changed, on the one hand, we can point to a lot of changes since I first began this work and since women first entered these jobs with great resistance, I might say. But so, you know, like, for example, I'll give one shining example, IBEW, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Lots of women in that union. And when I wrote, they had a terrific women's group that organized outside the official confines of the union, women electricians, they call themselves, to go where no woman has gone before. They had a T-shirt. However, they didn't allow the women electricians and the women's group. And over time, that has changed. And a terrific electrician just, you know, resigned as the head of that women's committee. They did terrific work. There's been lots of work with mentoring, which is something that the women really, you know, championed and tried to set up. And so, you know, there's been progress. However, when you invited me to come on the show, I decided to reach out to some of the women in my book and some of the advocates who are still out there. And I asked them that very question. What's changed? What needs to change? And of course, there's been very slight progress in the numbers. So increasing the minimum percentage, you know, the 6.5 that they set as a target way back when women entered these jobs, that still hasn't been approached at all. The numbers are still small. And then one of the women makes a terrific point about, she said, it continues to baffle me why so much educational and workforce development funding supports training and education for low-wage, dead-end jobs for women. You know, instead of putting that money into these skilled trades jobs, and which pay living wages, you know, I say in my book, men's wages, you know, a wage you can live on. And, you know, we look at other fields, and there's still so much, you know, for women to address and in terms of employment equality. But you look at lawyers and doctors. In my lifetime, that's gone from, you know, a minuscule percentage to over 50% in law schools and doctors. And yet, you know, we have this area of these skilled, high-paying, good-paying jobs, and the numbers are very, you know, very still very small, and the jobs are still very difficult. So much resistance.
I wanted to give 212-209-2877 for callers who'd like to be part of this conversation, 212-209-2877. One of the things that you reference here is about this progress. And I guess the thing is, doesn't this really start at the high school, middle school level? Mayor Adams is talking about universal summer employment. Doesn't the visualization, just like for young men and young women, start at this pivotal time? Isn't it important for women to be able to see themselves in these jobs that can pay $80, $100 an hour?
Oh, that's such a terrific point. And one of the women in my book, Joanne Jacobs, who's African-American, and she joined the fire department, and she has a card that has a graphic image of a little girl and a little boy sitting on a curb, and the idea being, you know, role models and what do you see in your world. And, of course, the numbers of women are so small that they're basically invisible. So that is very important. And, you know, one of the things I love about the women in my book and representative of so many women is that they're still organizing. They've been organizing all their lives. So they go into classrooms. I mean, Joanne used to go in and take her big coat and her hat and let the kids wear it and talk about what it was like for a woman such as Joanne. You know, she's not real big, and she's plenty smart, tough, and strong. But, you know, to go into a fire station and fight fires, and, you know, all of these things, the women are still, and one of the things we have, There was a tradeswoman coloring book, and now I just learned last week that there's a tradeswoman, not a, a firefighter's coloring book for kids. It has to start early, and the fact that role models are not easily available is, you know, one of the problems. Look, we have a real deficit of skilled trades jobs now, and women should be able to fill those jobs. And it's not, all of the women in my book show that it's not an impossibility. I mean, these are great careers with, you know, terrific skills and benefits, and, you know, you build a new world. Not everybody wants to go to college or sit in an office.
Well, and also, we know that a lot of money has been put through the pipeline with this federal infrastructure bill. And with your help, in the coming month, we're going to introduce our listeners to some of these trailblazers. I'll talk with you about that offline. But I wanted to ask you, we have a few minutes left, and I was fascinated about your new project. And it's, I guess it's Rebels with a Cause, the Struggle for Democracy with New York City Unions. Could you talk about that, or is it within New York City Unions?
Yeah, well, in New York City Unions, because all of the people in the book are from New York. However, let me just say that this is an, also an oral history, like Sisters in the Brotherhoods, and I did these interviews when, through people that I encountered along the way who, you know, they're... We have two images of unions. We have the unions that we know and love who, you know, represent people in grievances and fight for better working conditions and safe working places, all that. But we also have other stories about corruption in the unions and, you know, stolen pension funds and self-enrichment and weak enforcement. And so what I did was I set out to interview people in different unions starting way back in the early 90s. And these are their stories, and it's a story also of collective action, how they organized, what they did. All, you know, it's, I'm quoting from their newsletters and flyers and all of the work they did to try to challenge their unions, fight corruption, and have the unions we need, not the unions we have, in terms of that very problem of representation and no corruption. And it's a mighty tall order. I mean, these fellows were mighty, you know, I don't want to say, like with Sisters, I don't want to say that they're so exceptional, but what is exceptional about all of them, both the men and the women, is that they stood up and they said no more. They challenged what was going on, which is not an easy thing to do. So they, like the women, paid a big price. A lot of them had families, and they were unemployed for a long time. They were blacklisted, but they kept at it. So these are their stories, and I think it's indicative of what needs to happen, that the labor movement needs to recognize the problems of corruption and try to come to grips with how to put, you know, real things in place so that it doesn't go on and on. For example, like the UAW, that's a modern example. I don't have any auto workers in my book, but, you know, that's a good glaring example.
And we will explore some of this, too. We have one caller on the line. Caller, where are you calling from? What's on your mind, and what's your name?
Okay, hi. Well, first of all, what she's saying is amazing because I've lived with one for 38 years, Carpenter. Became an organizer, retired a business agent. Anyway, but what I wanted to talk about was the previous people about the schools. My thing with that is I have a person who graduated a teacher, 6 years, no job, just gets into the academy because what are we going to do? Graduates a cop, but makes a decision, you know what, let me go to my first career first. 7 years later, miserable, because of our school system, and is looking to go back into the academy to become a cop. This is how sick our system is. You're going to go from the fire to the fire pan because, and today, going to school and not wearing masks, she's wearing a mask. You understand? Because it's the masks that saved us. And now everybody's going to school with no masks. This is a sick system, sick city, and this mayor, the vegan guy who I love because he's vegan, I didn't vote for him the last minute because of what I heard, what he said, And what Curtis said, I went to Curtis, and I'm not a Democrat, not a Republican. They all sleep together.
Wow.
But
you covered a lot.
You know, it's a sick system, okay? Sick, sick, sick. Okay, union all the way, all the way. My husband's living on 3 pensions. Thank God for the freaking union. Thank God.
Right. But Thank you so much for calling early. We have to wrap it up here. I'm so sorry. We're up against it, and we have Democracy Now coming up next. Jane Latour, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be coming back to
you. Thanks for having me, Bob. And happy Women's History Month. Let's have more of it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Sorry for all the callers we couldn't get to. Make sure to tune in here tomorrow for Frenchie Davis. And Democracy Now! Is up next.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Ooh, 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 ooh. And I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. Feeling good. Dragonfly out in the sun, you know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean. Sleep in peace when day is done, that's what I mean. And this old world is a new world in a bold world.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Many consumers want electric cars that cost less and go farther on a single charge. Researchers hope to make that happen by developing what are known as solid-state batteries. As their name suggests, solid-state batteries contain solid instead of liquid electrolytes. Amy Prieto of Prieto Battery says that does two things.
It lets you store more energy in a smaller volume, but it also makes the batteries a lot safer because that liquid is usually flammable.
But developing solid-state technology is challenging.
And there are some really fundamental material science problems that people have been working on for a really long time that are just very difficult to solve.
Prieto's approach is to combine the compounds needed to make a battery in a unique structure.
Instead of thin films that get stacked or rolled the way a normal battery is made, we are starting with a spongy structure that's really porous, and that way we can pack a lot of the different components of the battery into that architecture.
The company has created a working prototype. Like many other battery startups, it's not yet ready for commercialization. But if solid-state batteries eventually do make it to the mass market, the technology could revolutionize the electric car industry. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
Hey, this is Shaka Khan, and you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
Hi, I'm Heidi Boghossian of Law & Disorder. Every Monday morning at 9 a.m., we talk about ongoing threats to civil liberties and human rights. That's every Monday morning at 9 a.m. right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.
WBAI's local station board is holding its next meeting on Wednesday, March 9th at 7 p.m. The meeting will be held on Zoom. It is accessible to the public and includes an opportunity for public comment. Please use the link on the Pacifica calendar and on the WBAI website to join the meeting. Or you can call 929-205-6099. Once again, the phone number to get in, 929-205-6099.